Tech Talk. Yeah, Michael Tech Talk Gassler on here, and I think you know what we're gonna have our good friend Jay Garman coming on in a little bit, but no Dave Sparky Saganaki today. He was in the studio live last week. You should go listen to that podcast, of course. But and you can find it at techtalkwrlr.com anytime you want to. But also, we're going to have a little discussion on the news today. And as I said, I'm going to bring Jay in fairly early here to share in the conversation and move ahead. And there has been a lot of stuff going on this last week, just crazy stuff happening, a lot of things to talk about. I know stuff that we're going to want to talk to Jay about. We're hopefully going to kind of skirt the sides of the political issues happening. Of course, the big things in the news this last week have been very political, very tragic deaths, and then the court cases surrounding two police actions that involved young black men and resulted in their death. And I know, though, that the aspect of it that we're probably going to talk about and touch on a little bit is not going to be the political side of that. You can get that somewhere else. I think what we're going to talk about is perhaps some of the things that can be done in order to prevent or to provide for action when these things do happen. And that's going to be cameras on cops, all sorts of things like that. So we'll get into that in a little bit. Like I said, I want to bring our good friend Jay on to discuss that. So we'll do that in just a little bit. A couple things, though, that I will talk about before we get in there. Did you realize Sony got they got hacked again? Oh, man. So if you've got an account with a PlayStation and all that, you're out of luck. Apparently, not only that, but it was also, too, there was a lot of information from security numbers. There was celebrity data, personal information, salaries, and home addresses for employees and freelancers who worked at the studio. And so, man, this is just, you know, it's just brutal. It's just brutal. Now, Sony Pictures were, the documents were leaked. Apparently, much of the data that was leaked, this was not a high-tech hack where they had to go into a database and disencrypt everything and all this other No. There's a couple of Excel files. You know, that's it. They had some Microsoft Excel files. We don't need to password protect that. Who's going to look at an Excel file, right, with all of the social security? Oh, my gosh. Yeah, so anyways, so that's that's not good. That's not a fun thing. Apparently, at least though, you know, it's rather than the typical leak like this that impacts every man, you know, you and me and everybody else that happens to do business with it. This actually impacted the people at the top. So who knows? Maybe we'll see some changes. Sony Entertainment co-chair Amy Pascal, her social security number was found in no less than 104 separate locations. Sony Entertainment CEO Michael Lynton, oh yeah, they found his info in 93 files. So that stuff's out there now, you know, and it's around. Now, the other thing that the hackers did, though, which is, I don't know what your feelings on this are, they said, you know what, we're not only going to take all this information just to show that we can, we're going to grab some movies that haven't been released yet. We're going to let you have access to those, too. So, for example, Annie. Yeah, that's right. The reboot of Annie. That's out there. You can download it if you're so inclined. I don't know if they've ripped it off of the webs yet, but it's supposedly the DVD screener of that was found. Still Alice, Mr. Turner, To Write Love on Her Arms, and also, too, one that was released, Fury, with Brad Pitt. That was already released, but I guess they liked that one enough. They wanted to get that one out there as well. Now, there is some thoughts behind this that the hack may actually have been on behalf of North Korea. Why, you may ask, would North Korea care about a reboot of Annie? Actually, they don't, of course. The reason that they're up in arms, both figuratively and literally about this, is because of The Interview. It's a comedy due to be released next month from Sony Pictures that stars Seth Rogen and also James Franco acting as TV journalists who become embroiled in a plot to assassinate the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. And he didn't like that. You know, Kim, he's not a happy fellow just in general. And apparently this made him even a little less happy. Little side note. If you're a Kim and you're thinking of naming your son or daughter, or I guess it'd be your son, Jong-un, don't do that. If you're in North Korea, guess what? You'll be forced to change the name. Yes, he's said there shall be only one. One Kim Jong-un, and he is the one. So anyways, you know, that's always fun, right? Just hearing about new ways that we have to worry about our data getting stolen. But hey, you know, maybe you get a, you know, download a couple free movies out of there if you don't have a you know, enough ethics to keep you off of the list. Of course, this is following on the heels of just a long, long string over the last few years of these security hacks. One of the most notable having been Target Stores. Target Stores was targeted by hackers in search of customer payment information. It was like, October, November of last year. Now, that's, you know, most people, I think, have almost forgotten about it with everything else happening. Well, most people have, except, of course, from the banks. So the banks now are suing Target for all of the pain and suffering that they went through, and mainly too because they ignored the attacks for a very long time, and in fact they had disabled an automated anti-malware tool, and then they ignored 12 days worth of breach alerts. And, and so the banks have said, look, we understand everybody makes a mistake, but 12 days of alerts that your security team said, eh, whatever, whatevs, we're moving on. Yeah, I got more important stuff to worry about. So this is going to be interesting. This is going to be interesting to see how this works. Now, they've filed class action lawsuit has been filed on behalf of five banks. Five banks have filed that, and Target is going to have to address this one way or the other. The judge has allowed this to occur, which is a new thing. This has not happened before, so it's going to be interesting to see where this goes, because it does open up the possibility that from here forth, Target and any other retailer like them that is dealing with a situation like this can and should expect to be held financially responsible for their lousy security. So there you go. Guess what? They're going to have to pay. They're actually going to have to, like, own up to the fact that they didn't do what we trusted them to do when we gave them our credit card numbers and all of our other personal information, which is why I'm still a big fan of NFC payments and Google Wallet and Apple Pay and all the other fun stuff. So that's cool. Another thing we talk about a lot here on the Tech Talk Show is going wheels up, picking up cable, getting rid of the cable thing and taking the wires down, or satellite dishes, as the case may be. And here's another really good reason to do that. I don't know if you heard about this. If you're not a Dish Network customer, maybe you didn't hear about it, or maybe you just didn't care. But millions and millions of Dish Network customers across the United States lost access to CBS. That's right, CBS. We're not talking a little A&E, sci-fi, something like that. No. We're talking, you know, big four network CBS said, we're done with this negotiation. And this included New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, 14 major markets completely without access to CBS broadcast. They missed the NFL games over the weekend. And then NCIS, which was the number one TV program last week, supposedly, beside and behind NBC's Sunday night NFL programming. So what is happening here is that CBS had given Dish Networks a couple of extensions for renegotiating the carriage contract, which they have, which basically it says, hey, we're the carrier. You're going to pay us X amount of dollars in order to carry your station. They didn't like the new terms. CBS didn't like the new terms and said, look, you got to make this better for us. They said no. They said no again. They gave them extensions. And then finally they're saying, no, we're not going to do it. You know, we're not going to continue the contract. The CBS said in a statement, we hope that we can reach an agreement very soon so we can all just get back to the business of providing the best entertainment, news, and sports to the Dish customers that we serve. But, of course, they're not there yet. So now, in the past, we've seen programming blackouts like this come pretty frequently for Dish, but others as well. Now, Dish subscribers recently, in October, in fact, lost access to CNN. They lost Turner Classic Movies and a handful of other channels. And again, all because of a contract dispute with Turner Broadcasting. Now, those channels were off the air for a month, a full month. So, you know, we'll see. Now, if I was a Dish subscriber, if I hadn't cut the cable yet, if I hadn't cut the cords, I got to tell you, I'd be a little incensed. I'd be a little unhappy, and I wouldn't be mad at CBS. I'd probably be mad at Dish because they're the ones that have taken my money and have put it in their pocket and have said this is the service I'm going to get. I don't know if Dish is going to respond to customer issues if they're going to provide any recompense. You can probably guess where I fall on the betting line for that one, and it's not too high up there. I'm going to hit one last topic of discussion before we bring Jay on. This may be something he wants to talk about. I don't know. I'll be more than happy to talk to him about it, too, but I just found this fascinating. If you use an Android phone, an iOS phone, any sort of mobile device, there's a good chance that you're either using the stock keyboard that's built into it, or you've found a better one and one of the top ones out there. And this is the one that I love. I use it myself. It's called SwiftKey. SwiftKey recently came out with not only the Android version that they've had for a very long time, but the iOS version. Once iOS 8 came out, which allowed for the replacement of the stock keyboard, SwiftKey jumped into that gap and has allowed you now to do swiping. You know what that is, where you run your finger along the keyboard instead of having to type individual letters in order to make your texting, your emailing, all your mobile device input much, much quicker and easier and seamless. It's a great thing. I love it. I'm a big fan of SwiftKey. You can get it for free as well. But the reason I bring it up is because one of the newest users of the SwiftKey technology has created a bespoke input situation for himself, and he needs it. Stephen Hawking, Professor Stephen Hawking, now uses technology from SwiftKey to assist him both in writing and in talking. You know, he continues to produce prodigiously for someone who is so extensively handicapped in their ability to communicate. He still produces a tremendous amount of writings and documentation and other things on his research and on his insights into science and all the things that he's working in. Now, they've worked with SwiftKey now, with Intel, to create a new system. It's called ACAT, the Assistive Context Aware Toolkit. And so this is an interesting thing. It's not only good for Stephen Hawking, who they're reporting that his typing speed now is twice as fast with the new system and a 10 times improvement in his common tasks, such as, you know, easier, more accurate, faster web browsing, faster editing, managing and navigating web interface emails and documents, opening documents, all this kind of stuff, 10 times as fast. So that means that he's able to really move a lot quicker. Now, the reason why this is so effective for him, and they're going to be sharing, this is a cool thing too, is that they're going to be sharing the research and the work that they've done in January. They're going to open the solution up so that it can be customized to assist other people with motor neuron disease or quadriplegia and other issues that make communication very difficult. The reason why this can be so much faster and why it's so cool is that not only does it allow for that swiping functionality, and I'm not sure how that's implemented here for him, but the back end of the technology makes predictive decisions about what you're trying to enter. And so for someone like Stephen Hawking, that can reduce the amount of actual typing and actual input that has to be made. In his case, they're saying by close to 20% or more, the other way. He has to type less than 20% of all of the characters that are required in order to get a thought across. So I just, you know, I love stuff like that. That's what technology is supposed to be about. It's just cool stuff. It's just cool stuff. Making lives better. That's what it's about. Speaking about making lives, let's make all of our lives a little better right now. I'm going to give our good friend Jay Garman a call. See if we can pull him in. Oh, we got ringtone and everything. You know what? I love it when stuff just works like that. We'll see if...
Hello.
Oh, and he is. I was going to say, we'll see if he's actually available this weekend. Sure enough. Good morning, Mr. Garman. How you doing, sir?
Pretty good. Yourself?
Not too bad. Not too bad. It's a good week. Starting off to be a good weekend. By next week, I hear we're supposed to actually get some decent weather, too.
What's decent by Chicago standards in December? Only 2 feet of snow?
Hey, we're not all the way up like Minnesota where I grew up. No. I'm talking like actual balmy weather, 50 degrees, which for December, I'm happy about that. That's not too bad.
There's like 11 months out of the year you'd be happy for that in Chicago.
Good point. Yeah, absolutely right. Oh, man. I wasn't sure if you wanted to talk about it or not. We've had a lot of conversations about how difficult input can be on mobile devices and so on, and I was just relating all the new stuff that they were doing specifically right now for Stephen Hawking, but that's going to have general application for a lot of people that have difficulty inputting information with devices. And he worked directly with SwiftKey to create a bespoke entry system, which is sounds just absolutely amazing. It's saving him a tremendous amount of time. I don't know if we'll ever get, do you ever use like a swipe sort of keyboard yourself?
I do. I find it slightly better than the default Android keyboard, but you know, my first Android phone was a Droid 2 with a physical keyboard, and that still was a far better experience than any soft keyboard I've ever used. And soft keyboards are just natively inferior. They just always will be, because there's no tactile haptic feedback from using them. That's distinct. That's just native to the interface. You can't, you know. Swiss Army knives are never as effective as purpose-driven tools. That's just not what they're for.
Yeah, and the thing that I hate the most about the soft keyboards still to this day is it's not so much that lack of tactile feedback like you're talking about, like for typing, but it's just the inability that I have to enter information without having to actually look at it. And as a touch typist, I don't want to have to look at my fingers in order to type something. I should just be able to do it. And that drives me a little crazy.
Right. Well, I mean, we have to be honest that mobile devices are not really designed for input or for creation except in extreme minimal sense. Mm. They are content consumption devices. They are not content creation devices. And as a guy who makes his living creating content, by and large, they frustrate me to no end. But I also know that I am not the mainstream market. Like, most people are passive consumers of content, not active creators of content.
Yeah, well, and that's what makes I mean, of course, he's just an amazing character for so many reasons. But one of the things that is really incredible about Stephen Hawking, Professor Hawking, is the prodigious amount of productivity that he has given his insane limitations. And this is just one of those is, you know, how do you get information out? How do you create documents, and how do you get the ideas you have in your head out into the world? It's tough enough for us, just normal humans, and then he's got all the physical limitations for it as well. It makes it astonishing to me. It really is.
Yeah, well, I remember having conversations a long time ago when Minority Report came out. I remember talking about, I loved that whole 3D interface where you could manipulate information and move things aside, and everyone's been trying to build that ever since.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of the more recent version of the Star Trek voice interface, which, by the way, Google's founders have basically said their whole organization is basically tacitly working towards, I want the computer from Star Trek. Where I just talk to it and it tells me things.
Yep.
But what people forget about the Minority Report interface is that he put on gloves to use it. And part of that, at the time was the assumption that, well, the computer wouldn't recognize his hands without the gloves. Now, we know that's not true. Kinect and things like that can pull that off. But what I also suspect is true is those gloves are probably giving some form of haptic feedback. So he knew, without having to have a visual cue, when he, quote, gripped an artifact,
mm-hmm.
the glove would tell him somehow. And I think as we get into more of these tacit user interfaces, we're going to want something like that. Charlie Strauss has written about the notion of having input rings, where we wear, like, jewelry on a couple of fingers on both hands that will vibrate or heat or give a mild feedback of some kind to let us know when we've engaged with a non-corporeal object,
mm-hmm.
which I think is important. You know, we're sort of getting into that in a lot of different ways that people haven't thought about. Because unlike the Star Trek computer, I don't want to have everyone hear out loud everything I want to do with my, smart device.
Yep. Well, and it's interesting you bring that up because they've been working for a long time on creating haptic devices with ultrasound and other technologies that would combine holography with these tactile feedback without having to have gloves and so on. And by a long time, I mean in technology, like a really long time, like 2008, 2009, there was recently something that came up again saying, hey, we're almost there now. It just seems to be one of those things we're just always, 3 to 5 years away from. There's a lot of technologies like that. We're like 3 to 5 years away from. And once again, that's what I most recently read. And until then, whether it's a ring or actual gloves, wearable technology of some sort that will provide us with the responsiveness that we need to really feel our environment is going to be an important thing.
Yeah, well, I expect the next 20 years of technology, especially, it's not is going to be as much about processor speed as it used to be. Moore's Law has done us enough favors that it's not as big a deal. We've gotten good enough at software development that we don't have to have this whole kitchen sink approach that Windows has, where you just got to run a ton of software in case you ever need an obscure feature.
Mm-hmm.
What I think technology is going to be about is wearables really are the future, but I don't think in the way a lot of people understand, or at least expect. We're not going to buy one sensor ring that we wear on one finger of one hand, and that's our interface device for everything. We're going to buy one Bluetooth headset, and we're done. We're going to have a variety of them. You're going to have fashion components, in some situations I'm going to have a full set of gloves, and sometimes I'm just going to have a ring, and they're going to be different colors and different seasons. And we see that a little bit now, like people have to buy winter gloves that have the right contacts in the fingers so I can still use my smartphone outside in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
We're starting to get more refined input devices, and I think that's going to be both fashion-mediated but also purpose-mediated. So, like I said, a keyboard and mouse are good for me and for some of my artist friends. I need a Wacom tablet. My coder friends need multiple screens, and my video editor friends need multiple screens at different sizes and much better headsets. We're going to have a much finer and more granular set of input devices that are also fashion devices. So if I'm, at work, I'm going to have my you know, I might have my business gloves that I use for very high-end, you know, feedback and artifact manipulating stuff. And if I'm just out for on the town, I might be able to settle for something that clips to my belt and just vibrates when I've, you know, interacted with the door object at a store or a bar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to be much more granular than that. And that's where I think consumer tech is really going to head over the next 20 years.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and I've been giving that some thought as well. And I think you're right. The one thing that I would attach to it is, at least right now, you know, I see us kind of eventually resolving down to a single source device, and you know, and hopefully it'll get to the point where it's about maybe the size and shape of a credit card, and that will be the driver for these myriad of other devices that we're going to rely on for voice communication versus you know, text entry versus reading and surfing. You may have, like you're saying, a different device for that, but our source device is going to be on us, and it's going to be with us, and it'll just be what allows us to always have that same identity and personality with the devices that we then grab and migrate to, depending on the situation and environment that we're in. You know, and right now that device, of course, is our phone, and that's starting to develop into just a source device. I really don't take my phone out of my pocket all that often anymore. If I'm in my car, it's automatically running my Bluetooth, and it's already allowing me to do any type of music that I want through voice command. I can answer and receive and make phone calls and texts and all that. If I'm out of my car, I've got my Bluetooth headset in my ear, and I'm running around and walking around with that. When I get to my desk, you know, I pick up my, I use Google Voice, so I pick up my calls on my desktop and do it that way. So, you know, like I said, it's getting to the point where I could just see that becoming, that's just de rigueur, is you don't take your source device out of your pocket. It's too dangerous. There's no need for it.
Well, and frankly, I think that's probably going to be true for the next 20 years, but over the next maybe 30 years, and I'm not really good at time horizons because I'm not James Cascio or Cory Doctorow and Gray about progression technology, I don't think we'll have a source device. Because really all the source device is a hub for all our peripherals, and it connects us to the cell network, which gets us to the server-side component of the applications and our federated identity. So frankly, my Android phone is basically just, in a lot of ways, a gateway to the internet, and in particular, my Google account, which I use to log into all their services. If I have smart rings or smart glasses or an earpiece or whatnot, and they independently can connect to whatever the next generation of cell network / Wi-Fi that's ambient everywhere, I won't even need the source device. They'll all independently, as long as I have some way of authenticating who I am, biometrically or through voice print or something with the device, oh, you're Jay Garmin. I will now reach out to the cloud, find Jay Garmin's account and all the services this device is intended to work for, and I'm done. Yeah. And I don't need that one hub device on me. It's going to be just about the peripherals.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you know what? You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. No, that's a great point. I think that that is true. You know, and who knows, at some point maybe we won't even need the those endpoint devices at all. It'll just we'll build it in.
Well, so sort of what I think about this, what's going to get weird and sort of like the sitcom jokes and relationship spats of my grandchildren's generation is, you know, my let's say I have a grandson at some point. My grandson has, you know, X number of accounts and authentications on different services as part of his federated cloud identity, and one of them is whatever becomes of ESPN. And his significant other has whatever it is of HBO. But, you know, depending on when you get in front of a screen that's out there that's picking up all the federated identities, like, how does that get me? I can only watch HBO when Steve's over. Because when Steve comes in, he brings in the room with him his HBO subscription. So suddenly Steve's really popular because he's the one dude in your social group that's subscribed to HBO. And he gets within 20 feet of a screen, it authenticates HBO because Steve might be watching.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you know, Jessica over here is the only one that has, you know, Netflix classics. We can watch, you know, the pre-reboot version of Breaking Bad. in classic 2D.
Yes, yes, exactly. Oh, man. Well, yeah, of course, we may just get to the point, too, where the screen isn't going to be the endpoint for us, and it'll actually be coming through our, contacts, or it'll be somehow made so that it's dedicated just to that viewer. So it doesn't matter who's looking at it. If you're not authenticated for HBO, you're not going to see HBO. And
that's true.
You know, too bad, too bad. Which, speaking of movies and all that, I've got to bring it up. I got to kick us over into a different topic. I assume you've seen the Star Wars trailer. I have some thoughts. I am very curious, though, to hear your input of what seems to be coming down the pike for us.
I am pretty excited. I've tried to avoid spoilers as best I could, but some of them have forced their way into my, or theoretical spoilers, supposition about the film. Mm-hmm. But just taking the trailer as an artifact by itself, I thought it was extremely well done about the choices Abrams and his team made in the trailer. For one, John Boyega is the first face you see. Mm-hmm. A, it's a new guy, and B, it's an African, it's actually an Afro-British person, because he's from England.
Yes.
Okay. It's not a bunch of white people in space anymore. All right, let's start there.
But he's a bad guy. The first one, and he's a bad guy. Come on.
We don't know that. I don't know that.
No, that's true.
It is greatly rumored that John Boyega is the male lead of the film, or the new male lead of the film, along with Daisy Ridley is the female lead, mm-hmm. who is the woman riding the fudgesicle speeder. middle trailer. I don't know that he is a villain. It just clearly, at some point, he ends up in stormtrooper armor on a desert planet.
Yes.
That describes Han Solo and Luke Skywalker in the original trilogy. They both were in stormtrooper armor at a certain point.
I was just going to bring that up. Exactly. So because I've seen that complaint online. People saying, you know, they finally have an African American as a lead, and of course he's an anti-hero. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I'm excited too. The thing that I liked most about the trailer wasn't even any of the specific things that they picked out. It really was just the gestalt, that feeling again of the New Hope, where it was like, I don't know what it was, but it really did a great job of communicating that same sense of excitement and wonder and just seamlessness of storytelling that you hope for. And I don't know if it'll be there. I don't know if it's going to exist, but that whole impression I got from it was just a really dead-on hit for the feeling of seeing that first Star Wars movie.
It had the right tone. I completely agree. I like that Abrams went out of his way not to show anyone from the original trilogy. And the only real thing we got as an artifact of that were ships, and specifically the Millennium Falcon, plus some updated X-Wings and some updated TIE Fighters. But basically, mm-hmm. we didn't see anybody we already knew.
Yeah.
That was important. I think Abrams is a better choice for Star Wars than he ever was for Star Trek, because he has he's a very deft visual director, and Star Wars is very much about spectacle more than Star Trek ever was, although I was glad he brought some of that, at least to the first Star Trek reboot. That sort of updating of the visual reference. And he's very good about mining mythology for familiarity,
mm-hmm.
But he's not afraid to sort of reinvent stuff. So I think he's a much better match. I'm glad he's working on Star Wars and not a third Star Trek film. I'm very, very glad of that. Because I think he's just a better fit for that.
Yep.
I will be curious to see if, because the first two trailers of the Star Trek reboot were really, really good. And overall, I liked the film. It did not hold up as well in later viewing as I hoped it would. And Star Trek Into Darkness was just a colossal mess.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and that, speaking of ones that don't hold up to multiple viewings, Star Trek Into Darkness, that was kind of like, if you watched it and didn't pay that much attention, you could get to the end and go, oh, well, that was really kind of neat and it was pretty. But if you paid attention or if you wanted more, and then if you tried to watch it again, yeah, it just did not hang together. And clear, I mean, it's certainly not going to be a classic. It's not one that people are going to pick up 10 years from now and keep wanting to watch over and over again.
No, it was, and frankly, what Star Trek Into Darkness was basically a 2-hour-long trailer for the J.J. Abrams rebooted Star Trek universe. Like, there were lots of really interesting scenes mm-hmm. that hinted at what could have been a good like television series or something. But trailers don't have to make sense. They just have to give you a taste of what's going on. And Star Trek Into Darkness gave you like 2 hours of really interesting ideas and people and lines and visuals that just didn't ever coalesce into a good story.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what story there was had so many holes and so many forehead slappers. Like, why are you doing this? Step back for a second and think, you know. It was very, very frustrating. So I'm very, very hopeful that this does not follow that pattern, that this, as you say, is a little bit more suited to his his particular style and for his personality, and we wind up with something that we can really be happy about, and even more so without Jar Jar. That would be or anything remotely Jar Jar like. So
yeah, well that's a case. All I'm going to say about the trilogy, the prequel trilogy, and I could say a lot, is that I recall George Lucas giving an interview and explaining how he picked the word Gungan to describe Jar Jar's people. And it was his 3-year-old. Mm. That was the name his 3-year-old gave to big pieces of machinery, because he was on sets a lot and saw lots of like forklifts and cranes and whatnot, and always called them Gungan. He's like, that's a good word. That's a word that's going to resonate. Like, 3-year-olds randomly saying things directly influenced George Lucas and the prequel trilogy. It's like, no. You were cool when you were 30. You doing what you were 30 when you're 60 is not cool. Stop.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and also, too, it kind of, destroys the whole meta-analysis that you want to make on movies that should have many, many multiple levels of meaning and of interest and of thought put into them. It basically is saying, it's just random stuff. You know, I just put it in because it sounded cool. Nobody wants that. Nobody wants that out of anything, but especially not out of a beloved series that should have and does have a lot of mythological elements to it that can make it much deeper than it needs to.
Well, if anyone wants to know where Star Wars went off the rails truly and deeply, it's go track down any interview you can get your hands on with Gary Kurtz. Gary Kurtz was Lucas's producer on Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back. And I got the privilege of meeting him at Dragon Con in 2012, and I've read a bunch of stuff from and about him. And Gary was sort of the guy that kept Lucas's sort of goofy, over-the-top pop cinema instincts in check. His influence is deeply felt in Empire Strikes Back. And so when he left after Empire, the Ewokification of Star Wars really began, because Lucas had no one to keep the Ewok-style instincts in check. And each subsequent thing that was produced was more Ewokified. You know, Jar Jar being the apex of that.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And that was one of the things with the original trilogy that just I never could get my arms, my spirit behind, was the whole Ewok thing, and then the songs at the end, you know, the celebratory little Ewok dancing, ultra cute songs. And it, what may have broken it for me, though, is I was in a lot of different bands in high school, marching band and all this other stuff. And for whatever reason, I don't know why, our band director absolutely loved that finale song from the Ewoks. And there was a score for it for high school orchestra and band, and we played it over and over and over again. Even the thought of it is making me just a little bit a little bit sick to my stomach just thinking about it again.
Well, then we'll just quickly change subject with a radically inappropriate segue.
Absolutely. Well, we could. The one last topic, of course, is the one thing that was shown on screen that caused a lot of discussion, of course, was the new Star Wars lightsaber that's got the wrist-slicing crossbar lasers coming out of the side. I've seen some interesting takes on it, good and bad, and in supportive or against it. I think probably the best response that I've seen for support of it was to say, look, it doesn't matter if it makes practical sense. It just tells a story about who this user is. And this is someone who, you know, just like the broadswords of old, is brutal, is bloodthirsty, is all about the battle and not about the fine-tuned art of war that the Jedi and everyone else we see with the more clean lightsabers would be.
Right. It is the most J.J. Abrams thing about the trailer, in the sense that it is clearly visually impressive. Like, the first time you see it, you get it like, oh, wow! And then you think, and you're like, wait, what? That is J.J. Abrams reduced down to his purest essence. And that's okay, because that works for Star Wars. Mm-hmm. Because if you think too hard about Star Wars ever, it breaks in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I mean, back to parsecs as a unit of time. three-meter womp rat. George Lucas literally did not know the difference between meters and feet. So when you say 3 meter womp rat, like, you or 2 meter womp rat, like, is it a 6 foot rat?
Yeah.
Are you freaking kidding me? No. He means a 2 foot rat. He's like, that's still pretty big, but okay. Like, you would not call anything 6 feet long a rat.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a desert bear.
Yeah, you could ride that thing into town, you know. exactly. Yeah, no, you're right. Star Wars works best when you keep it at that symbolic level, and to hark back to the earlier point, which is why it was so incredibly disappointing, some of the things that went on in the prequels and that emphasis on the symbolic aspects was given up in the name of story and in the name of somebody's OCD obsession with completing the sequence in the sequels. On that note, I gotta get OCD. I gotta find out what our geek trivia answer from last week was and get a new one for the next week and keep things moving along.
Well, last we spoke, which was before Thanksgiving, because life has been interesting for the two of us in the last few weeks,
mm-hmm.
We were celebrating the anniversary of the release of Windows 1.0.
Yes.
And Microsoft kept support up for Microsoft Windows 1.0 for longer than any other operating system. So the question is, how long did they support Windows 1.0? It was released November 20th. I'm sorry, it was announced November 20th, 1985, released November of 1987, and was supported until New Year's Eve 2001. They kept support for that thing out for 14 years.
Wow.
And not talking service packs. Like, the average life of any version of a Microsoft operating is about 5 to 6 years, but if you include service packs that go as long as 10, they've gone longer than that with – Windows XP because it's the most popular operating system ever. They got extended paid support through July of 2015, which takes it almost as long. But for any originating version, they supported it longer. And frankly, it was the first operating system they ever retired support for. And most Microsoft developers think the only reason they ever got in the business of retiring support is that 2001 was such a busy year for the company.
Mm.
If you think back to 2001, that was the year that Windows XP was released. That was the year that the Xbox came out.
Oh, yeah.
And that was also the year that they lost their first antitrust case, and there was a very good chance the company was going to get broken up into component parts.
That's right. All related around the same exact time. Yeah, I had forgotten about that. The Windows One, though, too. I mean, was that being used still? I mean, I know, like, right now, of course, there was the huge issue with XP because it's used on so many little devices that we like, you know, like our ATMs and things like that. was there any of that involved with it, or was it just they just kept trying to keep it afloat?
I think it was mostly, I suspect, I don't know this for a fact. Bear in mind that upgrades of operating systems back then were a much more arduous ordeal. The original Windows install disks were 5 1/4, okay?
Yeah.
So machines that were originally installed, I mean, A, they required MS-DOS 2.0 that you then had to install Windows on top of. So, you know, if you're in a situation like a hospital or a library or some industrial application where you just, you know, you sunk some money into a legacy system that ran on top of Windows 1.0, and you're just never going to physically replace the hardware or to replace the software, and there's nothing wrong with what you're doing, you just don't. I run into this at my day job where we make medical software. I mean, you would not believe how much IE6 is still out in the world because there's just no compelling reason for, like, for hospitals to go replace, like, the filing system computer in the back room they bought in, you know,
yes,
2002.
Yes.
It still runs, it still boots, it doesn't connect to the internet, it only connects to the intranet. And we've got some arcane, like, filing system that physical filing system that there's a DOS-based software package for.
Yes.
And we're just going to use that. And that's it.
Well, I've run into that myself. You know, I've been doing some consulting here off and on in one of the places as a warehousing location, and they still have the handheld scanners running Windows RT, and you know it looks like Windows 3.1, and you're looking at it like, oh my gosh, I forgot about all this, you know. And I've also run into the situation where people couldn't upgrade their Microsoft Word installations because if they did, all of the macros that they had created and all of the little VBS scripting that made everything in the organization run properly would break, and it would just all fall apart. And so you know, a little bit of baling wire, some chewing gum, a lot of duct tape, and you just keep that stuff working somehow.
Exactly. Yeah, it's change, man. Like, software guys, often, because we're software guys, we often forget that software is only a small part of an upgrade in technology. You have to upgrade your hardware, and often you have to upgrade your people.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to, like, change management is hard and expensive. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if the software is better, I still have to teach all my people how to use it.
Yeah.
In a large enough organization, there's always a certain percentage of employees I can't teach new things. So when I upgrade my software in a big enough organization, that literally means I have to fire some people.
Yeah. Well, and not only that, I mean, not only are there some individuals, like you say, who just for whatever reason are not going to or be capable of learning any new software, but many, many times, too, even people that are capable or could learn, they just don't want to. and they're going to fight you tooth and nail for any even remotely minor change to anything to do with their work environment and their daily life. You know, and there's something to be said for that, certainly, and we do wind up in situations where we're relying on, you know, obsolete or ancient technology or processes just because of that. But, boy, it can be frustrating. It can be frustrating for those of us that see the advantages and the benefits to making the move and making the changes happen.
Right. You basically have to show that the software is going to be so much better than what you had and did before. It's going to make you or save you so much money. It's worth going through all the personnel issues because they're all personnel issues. In fact, human beings intentionally engineer personnel issues. If I'm the only person who knows how to use this legacy system, you can't fire me, and I'm going to fight tooth and nail for you to ever get rid of this legacy system.
That is right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And that to me was, I think, one of the hardest won realizations for me in my personal or professional life was to realize that you can't always win that fight even when you have all of the numbers, all of the logic, all of the reason behind it to say this is the best action to take. Sometimes it still isn't going to happen. Even when you convince people of that, it doesn't matter because they're not willing to do that. They're not willing to fight that fight, and they're not willing to go through that struggle. So, hey, we're getting close to end of the hour, though. I gotta get the new question from you.
All right. Well, we just celebrated the test launch of the Orion space capsule, which is supposed to take NASA back into manned deep space missions. This is also the week. And this week is the anniversary of the last part of Apollo 17, the last time a human being walked on the surface of the moon. So the question is an Apollo 17 question. Apollo 17 was the last NASA mission to the surface of the moon. It put two human beings on the surface of the moon and some other vertebrate life forms that often get forgotten. I'm not talking about microorganisms. I'm not talking about viruses. Mm-hmm. There were other living things in the Apollo 17 mission. What were they?
Ooh. Oh, that's a great question. That's a great question. We're exporting, making our own alien, our own alien life out there. At that, I got to run. I've got Rob Shot First coming up here any second now, and he's getting set up. He's ready to go. Jay, as always, fantastic to hear from you. Thanks for hanging with us for so long today, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next week too.
All right. Have a good weekend, fellas.
Yep, you too. Take care. Thanks, Jay. Jay Garman, Geek Trivia, jaygarman.net. You can find out lots of stuff there. Like I said, Rob is ready. He's getting ready. He's almost there. I'm going to give you guys, I don't know if you'll be in the right area for this, but if you haven't checked this out yet, you should check it out. One cool side of the week I'm going to give you today, Google Express. Go take a look at it. See if you are in the delivery area. This is overnight or same day even delivery from some of the stores that you're most familiar with, like Costco and other places, especially during the Christmas holidays, because this might be a really cool thing. Now, I'm not in the right area for it. If I was downtown Chicago, like really downtown Chicago, I would be. But out in the burbs where I live, I can't get it. But I know San Francisco's got a large area they cover there. Chicago does too. Go check it out. Google Express and find that. I'm going to leave you now, though. I'm going to drop with one quick podcast-only song of the week, and I'm pulling it up here to make sure I give you the right name for it. Then, of course, you're going to have our good friend Rob Rigel with Rob Shot First is going to be on here, and he's going to talk to you. I think he's going to talk to you about, speaking of space, I think he's going to be talking to you about a little bit of Orion today is my guess. I'm going to leave you with what's that?
Never heard of this.
Yeah, he says, hey, what? Huh? Who? Should I? What is that Orion thing? I'm going to leave you with a little song called Get Free by, who is that by? Major Lazer. So enjoy this. It's a podcast-only song of the week. You got Rob Rigel and Rob Shot First coming at you next. You're listening to Tech Talk on WRLR 98.3 LPFM in Round Lake Heights, Illinois. Thanks and have a great week, everyone. Thank you.